Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, HPV, The Paradox of Protection, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Kenneth Alexander, MD, PhD, Maura Gillison, MD, PhD, Stephen E. Goldstone, MD, and Amy B. Middleman, MD, MPH, MS-Ed. Dr. Alexander is a professor of pediatrics, chief section of pediatric infectious diseases, Pritzker School of Medicine, the University of Chicago, Chicago, Illinois. Dr. Alexander has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Merck Vaccines. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Merck Vaccines. Dr. Alexander does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Alexander does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Gillison is a professor and Jed Coughlin Chair of Cancer Research, Professor of Internal Medicine and Epidemiology, The Ohio State University, Columbus, Ohio. Dr. Gillison has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as an advisor or consultant for Merck & Company, GlaxoSmithKline, Amgen, and Bristol-Myers Squibb Company. She received grants for clinical research from Merck & Company. Dr. Gillison does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Gillison does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Goldstone is an assistant clinical professor of surgery, Mount Sinai School of Medicine, New York, New York. Dr. Goldstone has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Merck & Company and QIAGEN. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Merck & Company and QIAGEN. He received grants for clinical research from Merck & Company and QIAGEN. Dr. Goldstone does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Goldstone does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Middleman is an associate professor of pediatrics, Baylor College of Medicine, clinical physician, Texas Children's Hospital, Houston, Texas. Dr. Middleman has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She received grants for clinical research from MedImmune, Sanofi Pasteur, and Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation. Dr. Middleman does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Middleman does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The goals of this activity are to improve awareness and knowledge about the prevalence and clinical consequences of HPV infection, increase recognition of the clinical implications associated with the evolving understanding of HPV-related disease epidemiology in male and female patients, enhance ability to evaluate and summarize current evidence concerning the safety and efficacy of HPV vaccination in male and female patients, improve identification of HPV vaccination opportunities in the context of the overall immunization schedule, and advance and maximize HPV-related disease prevention through effective communication strategies with both patients and caregivers. This activity is supported by Merck. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title. Hello and welcome to this CME activity. This roundtable discussion was moderated by Dr. Kenneth Alexander. Dr. Stephen Goldstone, Maura Gillison, and Amy Middleman joined Dr. Alexander in the discussion. Dr. Alexander started the program by commenting on the current status of HPV immunization.
And this is where I'd like to begin the discussion, because we're at an interesting crossroads in the world of HPV immunization. I think, in general, the immunization of our young women is, in most good pediatric practices, well accepted. And we're doing a fairly good job at it. I don't think we're perfect. We've got a long ways to go. But I think most people are accepting of the idea. However, there are now a compelling body of data that support the immunization of our young men. And how we're going to go about doing that and the rationale for doing so is the topic of this evening's discussion. Two vaccines, as you know, are available. There's a bivalent vaccine that's produced by GlaxoSmithKline, which contains antigen against HPV 16 and HPV 18, and a quadrivalent vaccine, which is produced by Merck Vaccines, which contains antigens for HPV type 16 and 18, and also antigens for protection against HPV 6 and 11. Both vaccines have been recommended for routine use in young women by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. As you know, the recommended age for immunization is young women ages 11 to 12. And then the ACIP has opened the door for immunization to females as young as 9 and for catch-up immunization for young women up through the ages of 26. Both vaccines are very impressive. Vaccine efficacy for prevention of malignancies and for premalignant states appear to be in excess of 95% and perhaps in the range of 98%. So in the spectrum of vaccines that are available to us, these vaccines are as efficacious or more efficacious than any vaccines available on the market. We know from cost-benefit studies that HPV immunization of our young women is cost-beneficial, that the community is largely accepting this as a good idea, and that most pediatric practices are offering immunization to young women. And the good news is insurance is now picking it up pretty much as a matter of routine. The safety data are in. There are abundant data that suggest that these vaccines are very safe. That what we are seeing is that occasionally teenagers, boys and girls, will faint. But in general, this is thought to be due not to what's in the vaccine, but of course what's on the end of the vaccine, that 1-inch, 22-gauge needle. And so we don't think that this is a vaccine-specific problem, but something related to the process of immunization. More than 120 countries have now accepted HPV immunization and have granted licensure to one or both vaccines. The Australians have shown some interesting success in their STD clinics, where they are immunizing young women and showing a reduction in HPV-associated diseases in heterosexual young men. Some countries are also vaccinating very efficiently using their public schools. Makes sense. These countries tend to be countries that have private payer or have single payer systems, but they're using schools as a venue to garner kids together to get them immunized. So I don't think there's any doubt in anybody's mind at this point. It's generally well accepted that immunization of young women 11 to 12 years old is well worth doing. Right? There are good study data that show that these vaccines prevent cervical dysplasias and precancers or dysplasias, vulvar dysplasias and malignancies, vaginal dysplasias and vaginal malignancies, and they are highly effective for the prevention of genital warts due to vaccine types. Also, the vaccines are cost-effective in our young women. What about protecting our boys? This is my young nephew a few Christmases ago. I bought him a hockey helmet. And of course, protecting our young men is every bit as important as protecting our daughters. So to begin our discussion this evening, I'd like to invite Dr. Goldstone to share some of his insights, some of the data around prevention of HPV-associated anorectal disease, and some of his comments to us as pediatricians. Steve?
Thank you very much, Ken. So HPV-related anorectal and penile disease. It's not something we thought about. In fact, we had very little data regarding it until recently. More and more data is coming out. And the graph that you see here is from the University of Washington, where they looked at college freshmen coming in who did not have HPV at enrollment. And this is penile and scrotal HPV. And you can see that within a year of being at the University of Washington, 30% of the boys tested positive for HPV. And by 2 years, it was 60%. And what this is demonstrating is that boys everywhere have rapid acquisition of genital HPV as soon as they leave home. And it's something that we had no idea about. This is a curve looking at the age-specific rates of HPV infection in women as well as cervical cancer. And what you're seeing there in the red line is that women rapidly acquire cervical HPV by their mid to late 20s. It peaks, and then it falls off. And women should have cleared it by their 40s. There's a small secondary peak in the mid-40s, which may be related to acquisition of new HPV infection or possibly reactivation of suppressed infection. We don't know. But in women, there's rapid acquisition and rapid clearance. And you see that the cervical cancer, which is the hashed line, peaks in the late 30s and early 40s, and then there may be a later peak later on. And it's from the women who don't end up clearing the infection. So keep this graph in your mind of women. Rapid acquisition, rapid clearance. And let's look at men. This is a penile sampling and scrotal from Anna Giuliano's group, where she's looking at men across age groups. And what you see here is that the incidence of penile HPV infection is anywhere from 30 to 60% across age groups, and it doesn't seem to fall the way it does in the cervix. And the same thing with oncogenic HPV and non-oncogenic HPV. So the incidence of anal HPV, and for this they looked at about 1,400 men in the Explore study. They were HIV negative at 5 sites in the United States. And what you see here is a very similar picture to the penile HPV with anal HPV, where it's between 50 and 60% across age groups. So again, no rapid acquisition and clearance, it's basically maintains across age groups. And the oncogenic HPV is between 20 and 30%. Okay, so what about HPV disease? Most people never know they are infected. And they're asymptomatic until very late in the course of the disease.
So, Steve, what is a person's lifetime risk?
Of HPV?
Yes.
Probably close to 100% if they're sexually active. Okay. Most people with HPV experience emotional upset when they're given the diagnosis. It's often the first and maybe only sexually transmitted infection they may ever have. And they often undergo costly, uncomfortable, and repeated treatments to try and clear the disease. So, what about genital warts? Well, it's very difficult to get data from the United States because it's not a reported sexually transmitted infection. But this is the data from genitourinary medicine clinics in England and Wales. And what you see here is that the rates for males and the rates for females are rising, and these are visits per year. And you can see that it's going up rapidly across both men and women. Well, typically, when I was a resident, Anal cancer was a disease of older women. Now we're knowing more and more about it. 80 to 90% of anal cancers are HPV related. The majority are due to types 16 overwhelmingly and then 18. Type 16 is found in about 70% of anal cancers and about two-thirds of high-grade dysplasia. And type 18 is found in far fewer, about 6% of anal cancers and 8% of high-grade dysplasia. And other high-risk strains account for less than 10% collectively of anal cancers. So anal HPV infection in a cohort of women. Now there's a lot of news about rising anal cancer rates in men who have sex with men particularly, but this was always a disease, as I said, of older women. So Mark Goodman and Brenda Hernandez in Honolulu looked at anal HPV infection in women. And their cohort from 1998 to 2003 was primarily focused on looking at cervical, vaginal, and vulvar HPV infection. But then they gave an option for women to contribute anal swab samples. And 400 and so women did that. And what they found, well, the majority of women were white and the mean age was about 40. But what they found was that 42% of the women had a prevalent HPV infection at baseline. So this was very high. It was shocking to many of us. And about a quarter of them had oncogenic or high-risk types. And 16.8% had multiple types, so not just one or two, one type. And then 50%, remember these women were only followed for about 1.3 years, so it was a very short follow-up. And in that time, half the women had another HPV infection. So very high. And being infected at baseline increased your risk of getting another infection, particularly if you were infected with HPV 16. It really increased your risk of acquisition of additional types. So, what's happening to anal cancer? And this is the United States data. It's the most recent data. And anal cancer is only found in about 4% of all lower GI tract cancers, but it's rising at about 2% a year for both men and women. And the other important point is the age is shifting to younger and younger men and women. So, the annual incidence of anal cancer in MSM is certainly the highest of anybody, particularly immunosuppressed MSM who are HIV positive, and also transplant patients were seeing a large rise in anal cancer rates. And the rates of cervical cancer in the United States before routine pap smears was about 40 to 50 per 100,000. And with aggressive screening in this country, we've dropped it to 8.4 per 100,000. So that's something we can be really proud of. But what's the incidence of anal cancer in MSM? It's about 35 per 100,000 in the HIV-negative patients, and probably more than double that to as high as 144 per 100,000 in HIV-positive individuals. So it's very, very high. So this is what we're trying to do here. We're trying to prevent progression. And many of us believe that high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesion of the anal canal is analogous to high-grade cervical dysplasia as a precursor for cancer. So in the top two pictures, on the left you see that yellow plaque. That's a high-grade anal lesion. And the same patient has that whitish plaque on the perianal skin to the right. These are high-grade lesions there. He was not treated, and he came back 3 years later, and he said, I think I waited too long. And what you see here is on the lower left is an intraanal cancer, and on the lower right, you see the perianal cancer. And we don't know where it started, if it started in the anal canal or perianally. That's not what's important. What's important is this is what killed this young man, not his HIV. And the other point here, people always ask me, how do I screen for anal cancer? You don't need anything fancy. You just need your finger, like we taught you all in medical school or when you studied to be a nurse practitioner. This young man went to his HIV doc every 3 to 6 months during those intervening 3 years. And if he had had a rectal exam, I'm sure the doctor would have found a lump or seen something and referred him.
Okay, so with that, Steve, one of the challenges we have as pediatricians is that for the first time we are vaccinating, and we're good vaccinators, but we are vaccinating for a disease we don't see. This young man died. Give me a thumbnail sketch of this young man's experience.
Well, you know, anal cancer is generally curable if you find it early, but it's not a nice treatment. It's 5 to 6 weeks of radiation every day and 5-FU intravenously and mitomycin, which makes them very sick. They're often hospitalized for it because they don't tolerate it, and they get severe, often anal strictures, etc. And then when they recur, they end up with an abdominal peroneal resection. So he had 2 years of hell and then finally died of disease.
And what's the age range of these patients?
30s to 50s.
Okay. Do you ever see it in younger patients?
Every now and then you do. You know, we may start seeing it younger and younger, but typically they need to have been immunocompromised for a certain amount of time.
And when do we start screening?
Well, there's a difference of opinion, and I think that we should really start screening in their 20s because even though you don't often see cancer in the 20s, you may pick up the dysplastic lesions when they're small and easy to treat, or you pick up genital warts. And I think it's a good time to start screening and talking.
Who would you screen?
Well, who do we screen? That's a really good question. And New York State is the only state with official guidelines from the HIV treatment guidelines that says all MSM who are HIV positive should be screened at least yearly. And then they say HIV positive women who've had cervical, vaginal, or vulvar dysplasia, and HIV positive heterosexual men who've had genital warts. But again, that's screening with cytology. Everyone who's HIV positive, immunosuppressed, and adults, which are out of the pediatric age group, should at least have a rectal exam yearly with the physical. So, anorectal and penile disease conclusions. HPV can lead to serious non-gynecologic diseases, including anal cancer and penile cancer. We cannot continue thinking of HPV as a woman's infection or a woman's disease. Rates of HPV-related disease in men are rising. The incidence of anal and genital HPV infection in men appears to be relatively constant across age groups. It doesn't fall off the way it does in women. And women and heterosexual men can have anal HPV infection as well. And I didn't show the slide, but there's a very good study from Anna Giuliano's group, again, looking at a cohort of men from Tampa, Cuernavaca, Mexico, and Sao Paulo, Brazil, and they found a 13% incidence of intraanal HPV infection in heterosexual men and about 12% perianal. So in all, there was about a 25% incidence of intraanal or perianal HPV infection in heterosexual men. How does it get there? Fingers. Back to Seattle, Washington, in those young college kids, a third of them had HPV under their fingernails. So, and again, I'm sure it's not a Washington thing, okay? So HPV is spread without penetration, it's spread with skin-to-skin contact, and it's probably impossible to avoid.
Yeah, we're going to switch now to the opposite end of the body. We're all quite familiar with the fact that HPV is associated with anogenital cancers in women. And now thanks to people like Steve, we're becoming increasingly aware about the role it's playing in anogenital cancers in men. But something that's still not common knowledge is the fact that HPV causes a cancer in the upper airway, and that's oropharynx cancer, which is a subset of head and neck cancers. So we used to think, back in the dark ages when I went to medical school, that head and neck cancer was largely a disease of people who were six-pack drinkers and two-pack smokers, and who were largely larynx cancers. Well, now people have to be aware, although you don't see it very often in the pediatric population, that head and neck cancers can arise in people who never touched a cigarette and who never really drank much alcohol. And that's because over the last 10 years, it's become clear that the head and neck cancer that we used to think was just one disease is actually at least two distinct forms of cancer with different risk factors, clinical presentations, responses to treatment, and now incidence changes over time, which we'll talk about. So as you know, the classical head and neck cancer risk factors are alcohol and tobacco. Diet and poor hygiene are known to be cofactors. The disease largely occurs in men, 3-to-1 over women. It's associated with lower socioeconomic status. But now we're seeing people in high socioeconomic status. A lot of my patients, I think one day I had a lawyer, a doctor, and then someone high up in the ranks of the military in succession in my clinic, all of whom who were at the prime of life in their late 40s or early 50s and who were diagnosed with oropharyngeal cancer when they presented with a mass that did not resolve after antibiotic treatment. So we now know this to be a unique entity, and it presents clinically as a mass in the oropharynx. Oftentimes, in 75%, the disease has already metastasized to the neck, and they'll have lymph nodes swollen in the neck. The tumor is poorly differentiated or has basaloid histology so that a well-trained pathologist can actually recognize it by its characteristics under the microscope. And it used to be that a cystic mass in the neck was a benign brachial cleft cyst. For reasons we don't understand, HPV-positive head and neck cancer will often present as a cystic mass in the neck. So if you see a patient with a cystic mass in the neck, it is HPV-positive head and neck cancer until proven otherwise. And these patients will often present with a mass in the neck, and the unknown primary is difficult to find. Almost all of those are HPV-positive head and neck cancer. So like cervical cancer, HPV-16 is the type we find most commonly in HPV-positive head and neck cancers. But in contrast to cervical cancer, it's the overwhelming majority. And what I'd like to talk to you about next is why this is important at the population level, because what we are experiencing is the burden of HPV-associated invasive cancers now switching from being largely among women in the United States to moving to the majority being among men in the United States. Fortunately, like Steve discussed earlier, we've been extraordinarily effective in reducing cervical cancer incidence rates in this country since the 1960s because of the introduction of the Pap smear. By contrast, we have no widely utilized or effective screening program for head and neck cancers. In that case, the vaccine, if it were effective, may be particularly important. So to study these trends over time in the U.S., investigators at the NCI and I actually obtained all of the tumors that were stored by the NCI SEER Tissue Repository Program. And these cancers had been diagnosed from the mid-'80s through 2004, and we did a detailed laboratory analysis to look at the portion of cancers over time that were HPV positive. And we looked at a number of different HPV assays because there's a little bit controversy as to what's the best one to classify head and neck cancer as being HPV positive, and we didn't want that to be the issue, so we did all of them. And regardless of what method we chose, we saw the same thing, a dramatic increase in the prevalence of HPV in oropharyngeal cancers in the United States. Amazing that in the mid-1980s, it was only 16%, by 2000 to 2004 that had risen to 72%. What does that look like when you look at incidence trends over time? When you look at incidence trends in the United States over just a 16-year period, oropharynx cancer incidence went up by about 28%. But when you look at HPV-positive cancers, that increased by 225%, or 7.5% per year over the 16-year period. And HPV-negative cancers, because of extraordinary public health benefits and educating people about the risks of smoking, by contrast, had gone down by 50% over this period of time. So it's really remarkable to see, in an extremely short period of time of only 16 years, the major etiology of a head and neck cancer, or any cancer, shifting from one cause to another. And as an oncologist, I have to think that this is probably going on for other cancers in ways that we can't measure. So, what is this doing for the burden of cancer caused by HPV and how we measure it? We were fortunate to work with fabulous statisticians at the National Cancer Institute who were able to not only look at the trends that we had seen so far, but project forward 20 years to see what the trends might, what we might be in store for. And as of 2010, incidence rates for oropharynx cancer among men crossed so that they exceed incidence rates for cervical cancer among women. And when you look at case counts, as of 2020, we can anticipate that there will be more oropharynx cancers caused by HPV among men than cervical cancers among women.
So make sure I understand this more. Is this because we're getting more successful with cervical disease, or is this because head and neck disease is becoming more prevalent?
It's a combination of the two.
Mm-hmm.
We anticipate that cervical cancer incidence will continue to decline because of the combination of cervical pap smear screening and also vaccination rates.
Mm-hmm.
By contrast, we anticipate that the trends we see over time for the last 20 years will likely continue among men. So we saw a 225% increase in HPV-positive oropharynx cancers in the last 20 years, and we anticipate we'll see the same.
So this is not just a case of more recognition of head and neck disease. This is actually more disease.
This is more disease.
This is more disease. Okay, so the question is, why are more head and neck cancers caused by HPV?
So that's kind of a question of why are we seeing these underlying trends. It's become clear that over the last 20 years or 30 years, we've seen a change in sexual behavior in the United States. There are more individuals having premarital sex, and the number of partners that a person has gone up over time. It's not that you have to have multiple partners to get exposed to HPV. You just have to be exposed to one infected partner. The higher the number of partners, the higher the probability that one of those partners was infected and you were exposed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's because of the increase in the number of sexual partners on average over time that we expect that HPV infection is more common, as Steve showed quite clearly in the genital warts data from Great Britain.
So while we're on the subject of sort of the links with you and Steve here, do you think there's an association? In other words, if there's more head and neck disease, more anal disease, does this mean people are infected more than one place at the same time?
Well, I think we have to realize HPV doesn't disseminate through the bloodstream like most of the viruses that we see, so that a person can have a cervical infection and yet not have an oral infection and not be at risk for oral cancer, and vice versa. However, during a sexual interaction, it's likely that transmission can occur to multiple sites in the body. So a person who has one HPV-associated cancer is at risk for all of the other HPV-associated cancers because they've had a partner that was infected to which they were exposed.
Okay. And, you know, just as an aside, certain parts of the body, not only just the sexes, but parts of the body may clear the infection better than the others. We've long known that there are a lot of women who will have no cervical HPV infection, but they'll have anal HPV infection. And it isn't that they probably only were infected anally, because many of these women have never had anal sex. It's what happens is they probably get infected in the vagina or cervix, shed the virus, and it gets into their anal canal, and then the cervix clears it, but for some reason the anal canal holds on to the infection. So, you know, I believe that if you're infected in one place, you've probably been exposed to it everywhere else on your body. It's just a matter also of where you clear it.
The question is, are there screening tests for head and neck cancer? This is really the crux of the matter.
Yeah. Well, there have been clinical trials looking at whether or not visual inspection of the oral cavity, oropharynx, and palpation of the lymph nodes in the neck results in early detection of head and neck cancer. There was a study conducted in India that did show a mortality reduction from a screening program. It was a little bit controversial because of its study design. So as a consequence of that, it wasn't universally taken up. In contrast to cervical cancer, although visual inspection and palpation of the neck is recommended, and oftentimes dentists do it, my dentist does, it hasn't been shown definitively in controlled trials to result in mortality or morbidity reduction. There have been clinical trials that have shown the vaccines to be extraordinarily effective in preventing incident infection, preventing persistent infection, and preventing development of premalignant lesions. By contrast, we have absolutely no clinical trials looking at the effectiveness of the HPV vaccines in preventing oral infection. So if you're evidence-based, we have to strictly say that although we're having this discussion, there's absolutely no evidence that these vaccines are effective in preventing head and neck cancers.
So maybe we're evidence-based but hopeful.
Yeah.
Please continue.
So that's what this last slide of mine says. I was an advocate for getting these trials done because I am a head and neck medical oncologist, and my clinical practice has completely changed over the last 15 years. So that I'm seeing people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s at the prime of life struck by this cancer. And I am a medical oncologist, so I treat them. And someone that has been through the treatment of head and neck cancer told me, well, what they did was they hit me on the head with a hammer and then they lit me on fire as a description of what we do to these patients. The treatment is a combination of surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. It is extremely morbid. Most of the patients experience a potentially life-threatening toxicity during the treatment. People can be left with permanent speech and swallowing disorders, physical disfigurement that affects their social functioning. We know that HPV infection is necessary to develop the cancer. And very few cancers do we have a necessary cause that we can target. So to me, what's important about the HPV vaccines is the second anti-cancer vaccine that's been in development after the hepatitis B vaccine.
Well, first of all, I want to talk a little bit about vaccines in general and adolescents getting vaccines. We all know there are barriers to vaccinating adolescents. And if you look at the NIS teen, the National Immunization Survey teen data, which should come up in just a second, we can see that adolescents in general have actually done pretty well. I think it's really important to remember that adolescents haven't had nearly as long as infants and children have to sort of get this expected immunization platform standard really rolling. And I think the fact that some of those numbers are as high into the 60s, 70s, 80, and even 91% for hepatitis B, which I think were helped a little bit by the infant program, but I think that's really laudable. And I think pediatricians are really doing a fantastic job. It is more difficult to get multi-dose series in, but I think that the data for HPV is a little disappointing, and I think it could be a lot better. We have seen in the 2010 NIS teen data, which came out in August, that adolescent females, so they're measuring females 13 to 17 years of age, about 32% of them have had one shot. 49% have had one shot, only 32% have completed the series. And we don't have a correlative protection. So we think that completing the series is very important in terms of making sure people really have full and adequate protection. So that's a little bit disappointing, and I think we can do better. Now, there are a lot of strategies, especially policy strategies, that I think have been shown to be very successful in helping immunize adolescents. A couple of them include state mandates, or otherwise known as school requirements. Those have been shown across the board to be very successful in getting immunization rates up. And other alternative strategies, like using alternative immunization sites, going in and using school-located immunization programs, trying to help with some insurance reform and helping with payment strategies. These are all very important policy changes that we can make. I think it's important to look at what providers can do in their offices that can really help. And there are some proven strategies. For example, the use of standing orders. I don't know how many people here use them. How many people use standing orders in their office? So sometimes that really helps. Not many people are indicating that they do. The Immunization Action Coalition actually has a great set of standing orders, an example of standing orders on their website that's really helpful. But standing orders allow immunizations to take place even when it isn't the doctor specifically administering them, and this can really be helpful. The use of screening tools, making sure that every visit is an immunization visit. Whenever you see a child or an adolescent, making sure that they get immunized. The younger the patient is, really, that's the time to immunize. The one you absolutely should not put off is the one that we know is going to be engender a potentially more vigorous response when you're younger, but also is really important in terms of getting it in before there's any risk of exposure. I mean, that's true for all vaccines. But we know that at least 6% of youth on the Youth Risk Behavior Survey from the CDC, and those are kids who are in 9th through 12th grade in both private and public schools, about 6% report having had sexual intercourse before the age of 13. The use of immunization information systems are also very, very helpful. Most states now have some form of, they're called registries, but they're really more fully described by the term immunization information systems. They can help you account for vaccine, account for storage. They can help you with recall. All of those strategies are extremely helpful and important in getting adolescents back. And a lot of times we all just need a reminder. There are also some programs that can help provider practices improve their efficacy in increasing their immunization rates. And one of the programs I'll just mention is the AFIX program. That's a program that you can learn more about on the CDC.gov website that allows practices, gives them sort of a strategy for assessing their vaccination coverage rates, providing feedback to those in the office, providing some incentives to help people move forward in their progress, and helps with an exchange of healthcare information and resources that can also help people improve. So we talked about a lot of strategies. There have been a lot of studies. One of the most important strategies, and probably the key strategy to help improve immunization rates, is for providers to understand that their strong recommendation of a vaccine is extremely powerful for patients. It's powerful for patients, it's powerful for parents, and those are the two decision makers you really need to look to in making this decision and having this discussion. So let's say you have a parent come into your office, and he or she says, I've heard the vaccine isn't safe. How many of you have had that happen? So, yeah, and I think this is really important because there is a lot of really bad information on the internet and a lot of really poorly reported, and I'm sorry to any reporters, poorly reported information through the media. The bottom line is, and what we want to make sure everybody understands, including our parents, is that there were thousands of females and males who were studied as part of the trials for this vaccine, millions of doses given since FDA approval, and there have been no serious safety concerns. The most common complaints, of course, soreness at the injection site. I think we have to give that one to them because who doesn't have that? And then some dizziness after the shot. That, again, is more common among adolescents than it is among young children or adults. And that's why we recommend that all adolescents be observed in a seated or lying position for 15 minutes after giving any vaccine. I don't want to encourage my child to have sex. This is another really common comment that I think a lot of providers hear. I think it's really important to understand that the decision to have sex, if anyone remembers that decision, is not usually based on a medical intervention. And in fact, there are some data that indicate it's very much a developmental decision. Much like anything else, learning to walk, you have to sort of, there's a developmental pace to it, and one event doesn't necessarily create a change in someone's plan. But I think it's also important to look at the data we have about other medical interventions and their effects on sexual behaviors. We know, actually, we did a little study at Baylor looking at giving oral contraceptive pills to adolescent females for medical indications and looking at the rates of sexual debut among those versus controlled young women. And, you know, the power has to be pretty high to see that, but we certainly could say pretty comfortably that there's no huge difference in rates of sexual debut. Other studies, condom availability studies, emergency contraception availability studies, have not shown any differences in rates of sexual debut among students in schools where these programs exist. And finally, again, the key here is providers giving a strong recommendation for the vaccine. It is safe. It's effective. The key, it prevents cancer regardless of the mode of transmission of the virus. And who really wouldn't want that for their child? So hopefully that will help give you some ideas for some strategies.
Thank you for participating in this activity. To proceed to the online CME test, click on the Earn CME credit link on this page. Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, HPV, The Paradox of Protection. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.